Welcome to episode 18 of our podcast series. This episode features material from our November 2023 print edition of the Residential Aged Care Communique. I'm Professor Joseph Ibrahim, the editor. This podcast episode examines in depth the pre-existing circumstances that contributed to two patients' falls and their subsequent severe trauma that caused their deaths. The common underlying issue in both cases is the timeliness of care. We also present the reflections of senior nurses at the end of the second case. Our narrator is Ashley Redman, a practicing registered nurse and actor. Let's now listen to the editorial.
Table of contents. Editorial. Case 1. A fatal fall unwitnessed and unchecked. Case 2. Solving one problem creates another. Reflections of senior nurses. Editorial. By Professor Joseph Ibrahim. Welcome to this podcast episode, which examines in depth the pre-existing circumstances that contributed to two patients' falls and the subsequent severe trauma that caused their deaths. The common underlying issue in both cases is the timeliness of care. The Institute of Medicine, in its seminal report in 2001 on the quality of healthcare, described six domains of quality, one of which was the timeliness of care. Timely care reduces waits and the potential for harmful delays for those who receive and give care. The underlying assumption is that our ability as aged care professionals to quickly provide care after recognizing a need leads to better resident and patient engagement and outcomes. The concept of timely care is often broadly applied to situations where it may take minutes or months to deliver care. Examples of care that must be fast arise in discussions about the importance of rapid administration of antibiotics in persons with severe infections or post-fall management with a head injury. Examples of care often considered too slow arise in discussions around waiting lists, especially in obtaining access to elective surgery or respite care. In the two cases presented, we see two different perspectives on what constitutes timely care. A misleading perspective about timely care is our singular preoccupation with the desire to deliver an intervention to treat a reversible condition. A perpetual emphasis on the rush to fix something broken often blinds us to the care that is still needed when the situation is irretrievable. The case of the resident dying alone following a fall that caused a severe head injury highlights how an opportunity to provide person-centered care was missed. See case 1. Alternatively, the sometimes long and meandering passage of time where a resident's condition changes slowly without an obvious trigger might mean we do not initiate a clinical review. It is a trap that occurs in such slow motion that we only recognize it after we are caught. In retrospect, after the resident's death, we see the missed opportunities where a change in the resident's behavior should have been an alert or alarm for us. See case 2. With this comes the regret that the apparent steps we should have taken are simple and familiar. If only we had paused to think for a moment. Every day, we put in place strategies to recognize when a resident's needs could arise so that care is quickly provided. Visible strategies are in the deployed equipment, the bed and chair alarms, the sensor mats, and the motion sensors at the door. Less obvious is the application of the staff supervising and monitoring the resident's vital signs, physical condition, and cognitive status. The effectiveness of these methods of monitoring a resident's needs is often taken for granted rather than challenged. Sensor mats may reduce falls if the resident steps on them. The mats send an alarm, and a staff member is available to receive it and respond quickly enough to arrive by the resident. However, the success of an alert system requires an appropriate and timely response, something that is not always possible in the real world. Another hidden complexity around observing a resident's vital signs, physical condition, and cognitive status is the decision-making behind determining the duration and frequency of these observations. When we ask, How often should care staff round at an aged care facility to check on residents overnight? The answers vary. The reason for this variation includes the availability of staff, the clinical stability of residents, and the reason for rounding. It could be to reassure residents, to determine if a resident is responding to a new therapy, to prevent a resident from leaving the facility, or to identify an unanticipated event, such as a fall. In both of the cases we present, the residents were subject to observation and yet both died in unfortunate circumstances. In the first case, it was due to a care worker not fulfilling their duties, so timely care was unavailable. In the second case, it could be argued that the observation was too infrequent, and once the event occurred, no timely care would have altered the outcome. An inquiring attitude is needed to understand better the optimal approach to monitoring and observing residents. We must ask ourselves questions whenever we deploy observations as an intervention, seeking to understand what changes need to be identified, what our response will be, and whether we have the time and resources to provide the desired response.
Let's now listen to a description of our first case report titled A Fatal Fall, Unwitnessed and Unchecked.
Case 1. A Fatal Fall, Unwitnessed and Unchecked. By case precy author, Dr. Bronwyn O'Gorman, consultant geriatrician. Clinical summary. Mrs. S. was an 87-year-old quiet and independent woman who took pride in her appearance and enjoyed an evening routine of watching TV in her chair. She had a medical history of dementia, diagnosed 6 years previously at age 81, as well as type 2 diabetes mellitus, peripheral vascular disease, heart failure, and hypertension. Mrs. S. had been living in a single room in her residential aged care facility for 3 years and had low care needs, being able to independently dress, use the toilet, and mobilise without a gait aid. Her risk of falls was low, and care staff noted that she would rarely activate her call bell. One evening, Mrs. S. retired to her room after dinner and sat up late in her chair, as was her usual routine. The evening care worker attended at 9 p.m. and then again at 10:30 p.m., the final check of the evening shift. Nothing unusual was noted during these checks. Mrs. S. had been awake and responsive, sitting in her chair, and had declined an offer of assistance to change into her night clothes and be ready for bed. The night staff did not hand over any concerns about Mrs. S. to the morning shift team. At 8:30 a.m., the morning care worker was completing her routine breakfast rounds, and when she knocked on Mrs. S.'s door, there was no answer. Upon entering the room, the care worker found Mrs. S. lying face down on the floor, unable to communicate. Mrs. S. was dressed in day clothes, and her bed did not appear to be slept in, with her night clothes still folded at the end of her bed. In the toilet bowl was an unflushed large bowel motion with a small amount of blood mixed in the stool and on the toilet seat. The care worker called the on-duty registered nurse, RN, who quickly attended the room. The RN found Mrs. S. conscious but confused, with a swollen left eye and blood on her brow. A blood sugar was taken, the reading was high, and the staff did not see any signs of a broken bone. The RN called an ambulance, and paramedics transported Mrs. S. to a tertiary hospital, where she was admitted around midday. A CT brain performed under sedation revealed subarachnoid and intraparenchymal hemorrhages. A chest x-ray appeared consistent with pneumonia, so treatment with intravenous antibiotics was commenced. In the subsequent hours, Mrs. S.'s condition deteriorated further. Following discussions with her family, treatment became focused on providing end-of-life care. Mrs. S. died early the following day, less than 24 hours after being found on the floor of her room. Pathology. An autopsy was conducted to determine the cause of death. The forensic pathologist found that Mrs. S. died of traumatic head injury resulting from a fall from standing height, with contributing factors of pneumonia, atherosclerotic and hypertensive cardiovascular disease, dementia, and type 2 diabetes. The forensic pathologist made several additional comments. 1. The precise length of time that Mrs. S. had been lying on the floor before being found could not be determined. 2. It was unclear if the onset of pneumonia was prior to or rapidly following the fall. 3. The brain injury resulting from the fall was irreversible and fatal, with no chance of recovery. 4. Mrs. S. had many significant medical comorbidities that predisposed her to falls, including balance issues and blood pressure fluctuation. There was no evidence of a tripping hazard in the room. A second medical report agreed with the findings of the forensic pathologist. Investigation. The death of Mrs. S. was reportable because her death was unexpected and considered to be the result of an accident or injury. There was also a question of whether the death may have been preventable, with specific attention drawn to the adequacy of overnight checks, which the night care worker should have completed. The coroner's investigation considered affidavits and statements made by family members of Mrs. S., aged care facility employees, including care workers and nurses, as well as managerial staff, the investigating police officers, and the forensic pathologist. Medical records for Mrs. S. were also reviewed. A public inquest took place in order to hear the oral testimonies of key witnesses, particularly that of the carer responsible for completing the routine checks on the night Mrs. S. fell. Coroner's findings. Mrs. S.'s room was in one of four sections at the aged care facility, accommodating 98 residents. Staffing overnight consisted of one registered nurse, RN, and three care workers. It was standard for one allocated care worker to perform three checks of each resident in Mrs. S.'s low care unit during the night. If there were any concerns, the care worker would call one of their colleagues or the RN for assistance. On the night that Mrs. S. fell, initial statements provided by the rostered night care worker detailed that all three checks had been completed during his shift, at midnight and 3 a.m. Mrs. S. was reported to have been seen as comfortable in bed, while at the final 6 a.m. check, Mrs. S. was reported to have been on the toilet, so was not disturbed after ensuring she was well and comfortable. In subsequent affidavits and interviews, the care worker retracted and changed details of his account regarding Mrs. S.'s location in her room, what she had been wearing, and whether he even recalled seeing her at all. There was no written documentation of the checks in the facility records, although it was unclear whether this was a requirement. The coroner found inconsistencies in the night care worker's statements and testimony in court, with the latter noted as not that of a credible witness. In this context, the coroner could not accept any of the accounts provided to the investigation by that night care worker. Evidence given by other care staff was found to be robust. The coroner's factual findings regarding the circumstances of Mrs. S.'s death were 1. Mrs. S. fell sometime between 10:30 p.m. and 8:30 a.m. and sustained a fatal traumatic head injury. 2. Regardless of when she was discovered, she would have not been able to recover. 3. Findings suggest that Mrs. S. was unwell at the time of her fall, given the state of the toilet and not being prone to falls previously. 4. The first and second overnight checks were not completed, as stated by the night care worker, with the third check unlikely to have been completed. 5. Even with all appropriate scheduled care, Mrs. S. may still have fallen and suffered a fatal injury. The coroner did not find any systemic issue that may have contributed to Mrs. S.'s death. Staffing appeared sufficient, Mrs. S.'s care plan was current and appropriate, and apart from the night care worker, facility care staff appeared to be hardworking, caring professionals. The coroner accepted that the facility provided good quality care and had no specific recommendations. The facility conducted a critical review of the incident. It implemented some changes to night shift protocols, with a new requirement that the rostered RN checks in with care workers following each round of checking the residents. The coroner commented that this protocol may be burdensome on RNs and ultimately not beneficial. However, there is no clear answer to the most effective, efficient system to ensure best practice in this context. Author's comments. There is a need for systemic improvement to allow the provision of timely care for residents in aged care facilities, including that which directly addresses reducing the significant morbidity and mortality related to falls. The frequency of falls in residential aged care facilities is confronting. An estimated 30 to 50% of residents fall each year, and 40% of those will fall more than once. Many fall prevention tools and strategies will focus on a post-fall assessment, which provides an opportunity to review an individual's fall risk factors and implement relevant changes to a care plan after falling for the first time. A first fall can effectively serve as a warning incident and may signal increased frailty and vulnerability, which can then be addressed. However, as this case demonstrates, the first fall can be devastating. It is unrealistic to suggest that 100% of falls can be prevented, a truth for those living in the community, as well as those in residential aged care facilities. As the coroner noted in the case of Mrs. S, even if all scheduled checks had occurred, she may still have suffered a fatal fall. Injury minimization is, therefore, a key strategy to falls management and involves staff at all levels of care and across all disciplines. For the individual, interventions relate to increasing muscle and bone strength and therefore reducing the risk of fractures that may result from a fall. Vitamin D supplementation, optimized calcium and protein dietary intake, plus or minus supplementation, osteoporosis screening and treatment, wearing of hip protector garments. For the residential aged care facility, interventions primarily relate to timely identification of a fall to allow early assessment and management of possible injury and/or illness. Provide access to call bells or use fall alarms and sensors, regular rounding and checks, first aid and post-fall assessment. In the case of Mrs. S, the coroner speculated that if scheduled checks had been completed, the night care worker may have found Mrs. S earlier after her fall and thus been able to prevent or minimize any prolonged distress, notwithstanding the inevitably fatal outcome. It is interesting to consider that we accept regular rounding or checks as staple practice in this context, despite this system's inherent delays to care. Regular, timely rounding is limited by staffing levels and workload, two key issues regularly highlighted as needing addressing in the sector. I often hear residents or family members saying things like, "The staff are lovely, but there are not enough of them. They run off their feet." The coroner in this case commented that the facility had made protocol changes to how regular checks were conducted that were likely to create an extra burden on staff, but acknowledged that there was no obvious better system. It is high time to look beyond the constant loading of our traditional models of care and improve broader upstream systems, including incorporating technologies to assist with the timely identification of resident care needs and incidents like falls. At the heart of this case is the worry that an opportunity to provide the best person-centered care was missed and that an unwitnessed fall went unchecked for too long. Perhaps it is also an example of such little buffer in a system that is too reliant on individual staff, who are also limited by upstream constraints on staffing ratios, training, and access.
Let's now listen to a description of our second case report titled "Solving One Problem Creates Another."
Case 2. Solving one problem creates another. Case Precy author, Professor Joseph Ibrahim. Clinical summary. Miss A was a 79-year-old female who resided in an aged care facility for approximately 7 years and spoke weekly with her family. Miss A had a past medical history of falls, subdural hematoma, vascular dementia, alcohol use disorder, hypertension, hyperlipidemia, anxiety disorder, and ischemic heart disease requiring coronary artery bypass grafting. During the 6th year of her residency at the aged care facility, Miss A was described as increasingly and intermittently irritable, with frequent exit-seeking behaviour, such as trying to leave the facility unaccompanied. At the start of the 7th year of her residency, Miss A was relocated to a secure unit on the 2nd floor, where she made friends with a male co-resident. This change created a new concern for staff about possible inappropriate physical contact. Staff had observed the couple kissing on several occasions. Miss A's exit-seeking behaviour continued with her verbalising her frustration, making the statements, "I want to escape. It's like I'm in jail." Eventually, Miss A was relocated again, this time to a secure unit on the 3rd floor. The intent was to separate her from the male resident while addressing her exit-seeking behaviour. Staff organised supervised visits for Miss A and the male co-resident to support their friendship and instituted hourly checks for a period of time after the move. Over the next 2 weeks, Miss A was more irritable and displayed responsive behaviours more frequently. These included exit-seeking and violent verbal and physical interactions with staff that required the emergency response code to be called multiple times. Staff held a multidisciplinary meeting, and a new care plan was developed. The following day, early in the morning, Miss A was seen by staff walking in the hallway. Approximately 2 hours later, a passerby found Miss A lying on the ground outside. The paramedics were called, but cardiopulmonary resuscitation was not attempted, as Miss A was dead. Pathology. The cause of death following an autopsy was multiple blunt force injuries. There was an elevated level of venlafaxine, 2.6 plus minus 0.2 milligrams per mil, with reference noting that chronic administration of venlafaxine, 225 milligrams daily, resulted in levels of an average of 0.2 milligrams per litre, ranging up to 1.4 milligrams per litre. This toxicology finding was not related to the cause of death. Investigation. The coroner asked the Geriatric and Long-Term Care Review Committee to review the circumstances leading up to the death of Miss A. The committee reviewed the coroner's investigation statement, post-mortem examination report, health records, police report, and the regulator inspector's report. Miss A's prescribed medication at the time of her death included venlafaxine 150 milligrams orally twice daily, trazodone 150 milligrams orally at bedtime, lorazepam 1 milligram orally twice daily, and risperidone 1 milligram orally daily pro re nata as needed. Documentation and care planning around intimate behaviour were unclear. The staff on the 3rd floor recalled that on that morning, Miss A's room was cold as the window was open and the screen down. The maintenance staff was called and arrived within about 15 minutes to close and secure the window with new screws so it could not be opened. The recordings from the closed-circuit television cameras at the facility showed Miss A falling headfirst from her 3rd floor window to the ground below. The regulator's inspector explained the existence of a rule that stipulated every window in the home that opens to the outdoors and is accessible to residents has a screen and cannot be opened more than 15 centimetres. Despite this rule, the inspector found that staff had noted that the windows could be easily removed without tools to facilitate cleaning and that staff had done so on several occasions. A review of the facility's preventative maintenance procedures found that there were requirements for the environmental services to inspect the windows monthly and to ensure they were in good repair, and that the window opened no more than 10 centimetres. Staff reported that this was not completed regularly. The aged care provider was found to have failed to comply with ensuring that the home was a safe and secure environment for its residents. Coroner's findings. The coroner concluded that the manner of death was an accident, that Miss A had fallen to her death after opening and climbing out the window of a third floor room. There did not appear to have been any outside support or consultation sought to support Miss A from a behavioural or psychiatric perspective. There also did not appear to have been any review of her psychiatric medications since her entry into the aged care facility. The combination of her prescribed levels of venlafaxine and trazodone may have contributed to a serotonin syndrome that would have worsened her irritability and restlessness and further impaired her cognition. The relatively high venlafaxine levels in Miss A's blood analysis supported the interpretation that a serotonin syndrome drove some, possibly the majority, of her behaviours. The coroner made three recommendations. The first recommendation was that all aged care facilities should have easy and timely access to behaviour support teams and geriatric psychiatry to assist in the care of residents with dementia who have complex behavioural challenges. The second recommendation was that all aged care facilities audit their window and door compliance and perform yearly safety and compliance checks. The third recommendation was that all physicians in aged care facilities be aware that serotonin syndrome may emerge in older people with dementia, even if they have previously tolerated a given dose of psychiatric medication at a younger age. The risk of developing serotonin syndrome increases with the number of serotonergic medications prescribed. Author comments. In Australia and the United States, a code grey is called in healthcare and residential care facilities if the threat is a combative person without a weapon. In contrast, Canada assigns the designation of a code white.
Let's now listen to the reflections of senior nurses.
Reflections of senior nurses. Our experienced senior nurses focused on the death and management of Miss A, as described in Case 2. Curiously, the death of Miss A was considered an accident. It could be seen as a preventable death, as several factors may have contributed to the outcome. Specifically, Miss A was transferred to a new environment with possibly new staff at a vulnerable time, lack of medical assessments and suboptimal medication management, and failure to adhere to building standards. Miss A has a past medical history of multiple chronic conditions, including cerebral injuries and a psychotropic medication burden with a very fragile cognitive reserve, making her very vulnerable to decompensating with any changes in her care. The change in her condition following a previously stable situation for many years should trigger a full medical, nursing, and medication review. This review should have occurred before any further decisions, particularly a change of residency. Any new or changed behaviour, particularly intimate behaviour, and physical contact with another person must be navigated with the utmost caution and the best efforts to ensure an organic, reversible, or psychiatric cause is not driving this behaviour. Miss A's changed behaviour may have been due to the antidepressant or the onset of delirium. The multiple code calls are another alert and a second opportunity for a complete medical, nursing, and medication review. The typical response of having security staff attend to monitor and contain residents or patients is suboptimal. It does not address the need for a prompt medical review, further investigations, specialist review, or revision of care planning. It would be preferable that the response to these codes is changed to be more akin to what happens with a MET, medical emergency team, call. A code grey should stipulate the need for urgent medical and nursing response and review under the guidance of a geriatrician or psychiatric specialist, not just a security team. Lack of safe and easy access to the outside world reduces a person's quality of life, and an aged care facility may feel like jail. A better strategy would have been to coordinate supervised time outdoors, and it seems counterintuitive to relocate a person with exit-seeking behaviour to the third floor of the facility. There is little information available about family input. They were living geographically distanced but still spoke weekly. There is always value in asking the family to be involved in the risk assessments and any decisions about relocating residents. There were insufficient details about how Miss A interacted with a male co-resident and how staff concluded that this was inappropriate physical contact. These situations require a structured and comprehensive approach. We would usually discuss with the residents separately to gain their perspective, obtain a medical assessment, and meet with their family of legally appointed medical decision maker. We would discuss what had occurred and options to mitigate the ongoing risks. We would then escalate the matter to senior management to ensure any mandatory reporting was considered and followed up as required. Equipment maintenance and ensuring a safe environment could include regular checks on not only windows and doors, but also lifting equipment and lifting sling integrity in chairs. It is unclear if the staff had removed the window for cleaning in the presence of Miss A, who may have retained this knowledge and applied it in her efforts to seek an exit. It is helpful to involve clinical staff in these reviews, ensuring they are aware of these risks. They can also look for any concerns between designated check times and identify issues, such as broken windows or rusty chairs. Another aspect is to include safe workload checks, SWL, and ensuring equipment is labelled with the SWL during these occupational health and safety checks is worthwhile.
Thank you for listening to this podcast episode. Remember, the online print versions are available at our website at www.thecommuniques.com, which also includes a list of the recommended resources and references. I'm Joseph Ibrahim. Thanks for listening.